It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about why one publication deemed Milwaukee to be one of the worst-run cities in America.
But first, when it comes to growing up, there are no years as turbulent as the teenage years. From emotional ups and downs to dramatic shifts in behavior, teens can often have their parents asking, why is my son or daughter acting that way?
Our next guest has studied the adolescent brain and how it develops, and in a new book, he tries to explain why teens act the way they do and how to promote better understanding between parents and their teens.
Our guest is Dr. Daniel Siegel. He's a professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine and executive director of the MindSight Institute. His new book is Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. Dr. Siegel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start with a positive. A lot of people look at the teen years as some of the worst you can have in life, but you write that adolescence is an essential time for a lot of things. Can these years actually be some of the best years in some ways?
Absolutely. You know, I think there's a lot of myths out there that make adolescents appear as individuals to be people who are, you know, strewn with raging hormones that drive them out of their minds, or adolescence as a period of time is something we should just get through and hope we survive it. But instead, when you look at the science of adolescence, you realize there's actually an essence to it that can be really cultivated well, and you can have an emotional passion, you can have great relationships, you can have a lot of creativity, in fact, with courage that is the core of actually how we can live vital lives throughout the lifespan, not just when we're adolescents. And so what Brainstorm tries to do is present the science of adolescence, bust the myths that are out there that actually disempower teenagers and older adolescents, and then show what the truths are so that we can actually turn what's usually seen as a very negative time into a very positive one.
The way people talk about teenage brains, and I've probably been guilty of this in my life, it's almost like it's a pathology, right? It's a negative diagnosis. But how do we come to think of it that way?
You know, I think the adolescent period is challenging. There are a lot of changes that we never understood before, and what we see in adolescence is, number one, the onset of puberty, where the body is changing with sexual maturation, and it makes kids act in new ways, different from a child. And so for a young teenager, it can be a very confusing time. The second thing that happens is, in early adolescence, there is impulsivity, where there's action without thought. And while that gets less as we go through the adolescent years, there continues to be risk-taking behavior that baffles adults. And it isn't until recently, when we've seen into the circuitry of the brain, that we've come to understand the nature of that risk-taking behavior and why, in fact, adolescence can be a very dangerous period of life. And when we understand those changes in circuitry, we can actually do something about it. And I think a third thing that goes on is that the period of adolescence goes beyond the teenage years. And so we see this period of time seeming to go on and on into the 20s. And in fact, now we know that the changes in the brain continue into the mid-20s. So we can understand why this is not a period that ends as the teenage years end, but actually goes on even further. So when we see the clarity of the new science, we actually can reframe what adolescence is, which will be helpful for the adults that care for adolescents, but also for adolescents themselves.
You mentioned that the raging hormones concept is a myth, that it's actually just a brain development. So what is happening? And I know this is a huge question, but what are some of the basics of what's happening in the brain during adolescence?
Well, I'll tell you, my in-laws are in Wisconsin, and shout out to Betty and Neil. And recently I was in Lake Geneva, where we rented a house. It was so cold there. And we had adolescents from 14 to 20 living in this house, and it was so cold, as you remember, over the Christmas time, that we just stayed indoors. And I was talking to them about the book, and I was saying to them, look, let's talk about your life. And we actually had meals, since it was so cold, together, where we talked about what life was like as a child and how it was different once they hit adolescence. And so what we could see when we looked at life this way was that you can actually take the adolescent period and understand it now where it's not raging hormones. The changes in the brain basically can be summarized by the word remodeling. And what remodeling means is that you are pruning down extra connections among the basic cells of the brain, and then you are leading to myelin, which is a growing the sheath that connects the remaining neurons so they coordinate and balance with each other in a much more efficient manner. So this is a really new way of thinking about the brain, that it's remodeling itself. The second thing that happens in the brain that's really important is there are circuits of reward called dopamine circuits, and these circuits are changing such that the adolescent has a lower baseline level of dopamine and a higher release level. And what that means basically for an actual experience is you can feel bored as an adolescent unless you're doing things, and the kinds of things you want to do are new things. Novelty secretes dopamine. And so there's a natural drive to even take risks and do things that you wouldn't have done as a child. When adults see this, they go, oh, well, you know, it's raging hormones, or these adolescents are losing their minds, when in fact, it's very adaptive for the brain to make these changes and get the teenager ready to leave home. It's really a preparation period that helps the individual get ready to go out into the world. And also for our species, adolescents actually are the major source of innovation. If you think about what happens in art, in music, in science, and in technology, the major innovations have come from adolescent minds. And the reason is that the adolescent brain is going through this remodeling, and it's basically saying, let me push against adults, let me get more independent from my parents, let me get myself ready to leave home, and let me try to create a new world different from the world that I'm handed from the adults in my life.
And you make the case that not only should we not be fighting back against that, at we adults, we should be learning from it.
Absolutely. We really do need to learn from this essence of adolescence. And, you know, when I wrote the Brainstorm book, I wrote it for adolescents themselves as well as adults. And what was striking was that you could really find a way to identify the essence, which is actually an acronym, meaning there are letters that spell the meaning of the word, emotional spark, E-S, social engagement, S-E, novelty, that's the N, and C-E, to complete the word essence, is creative explorations. These four elements come from the remodeling adolescent brain, and it turns out that when you study the adult brain, like your brain and my brain, the way we can keep our brain young is actually based on these four elements: keeping passion in our lives where we care about what's going on, that's the emotional spark, having supportive relationships in our lives, this is the social engagement, having novelty where we try new things, and keeping our minds challenged with creative explorations. If you as an adult listening to this say, how do I keep this essence going on in me, you will have a higher chance of keeping your brain vital, connected, growing throughout the lifespan. And so in many ways, what was fun about writing the book, and I'm going to be really excited to see how it turns out, is that if adolescents read this, they'll realize that this essence is something they can cultivate, and I have skill trainings in the book so that you can learn to cultivate the essence in your life. And for the adult reading it, they may say, wow, I actually can reclaim this essence that I may have given up because I thought it was just childish to have these things. But in fact, these are the exact things we need as we grow into our adulthood throughout the lifespan.
For the teens, you say all four of those things you just listed, novelty seeking, social engagement, increased emotional intensity, and creative exploration, all have upsides and downsides. Let's chase the novelty seeking a little more. What are the up and downsides of that for an adolescent?
Yeah, well, let's start with the downside. Let's start with the upside, because then you'll see why it's there. You know, the way to think about this is the brain needs to change in a certain way so that the child, comfortable at home with what's familiar, certain, and safe, can have some kind of change in their brain that gets them drawn to the unfamiliar, the uncertain, and in some ways, the unsafe. So to give the courage that the child needs to get ready to leave the comfort of home, you've got to do something in the brain. So the changes in the dopamine circuit allow a child to seek novelty, and other changes in other parts of the brain allow you to reason through choices in a different way, where you basically are emphasizing the positive aspect of a choice. This has a downside, it too, because what happens is your brain is focusing only on the thrill and de-emphasizing its focus on the potential dangers. And so, of course, risky behavior happens. And in this risky behavior, what happens is you are three times more likely to encounter something that injures you in a very serious way, if not seriously threatens your life. And so adolescence is definitely a dangerous time of life because the brain is programmed to try out risky things. And what I do in the book is I say, look, if we understand the brain mechanisms of it, so seeing the actual thing that's going on rather than calling it raging hormones, you can teach adolescents to have what's called, what I call, an internal compass, where you have them draw on their feelings, literally in their heart, in their intestines. These gut feelings and heartfelt senses are a source of intuition. And when adolescents get in touch with their intuition, they actually can be guided into positive directions. So instead of just saying, I won't do it because my mom told me not to do it, they actually say, you know, my gut is telling me, even though my head is saying I'm going to drive 100 miles an hour down a surface street, my gut is saying there's something about that that's not quite right. I think I have a feeling I shouldn't do it. That's coming from the adolescent's own internal compass that will direct them in positive ways. So you can deal with the downsides, and that's what I try to do in the book, is talk about the downsides as well as the upsides, how to minimize the downsides and optimize the upsides.
We're talking with Dr. Daniel Siegel about the power and purpose of the teenage brain, and we want to hear from you. What questions about the adolescent mind do you have? If you're the parent of a teenager, or if you're a teenager, we'd love to hear your experiences, good and bad. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email, talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Dr. Daniel Siegel about how the brain develops during the teenage years. His new book is Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your questions and experiences. We'll go right to the phones. We've got Julie with us in Racine. Julie, hi.
Hi there.
What's your question?
Well, I have a child who is 16 years old, going through puberty, but his brain is different. And I'm listening to this with interest. My son has autism, and it's considered developmentally delayed. And I'm wondering if the doctor has looked at any of those kind of differences in relation to what he's talking about with his studies, and how to understand that it's not, quote-unquote, raging.
Gotcha. Thanks, Julie, for the question. Interesting, Dr. Siegel.
Yeah, thanks, Julie, for bringing that up. You know, at UCLA, we have a big center that works with kids on the autism spectrum, and we've done work directly with them clinically, but also work understanding how the brain may be uniquely developing during this period. And what I would suggest to you is that some of the changes that happen in adolescence are really important to understand, that when you're challenged in this area that I actually teach in the book called Mindsight, this ability to see the mind, to sense feelings and thoughts, to understand your own feelings and thoughts, to sense them in someone else, it's one of the most important areas that's challenged in autism. And there are ways of helping kids learn to do that. Usually it's best done not so much with a book, which you can try to do with this Brainstorm book, but it's best done with a one-on-one kind of relationship in a professional setting or with you as a parent. So Mindsight, the skills that are taught in the book, in general, is what someone with autism needs to try to learn, and it will really help his adolescent period go better the more he can understand his own inner feelings and what they mean for him, and also try to interpret what's going on inside of another person's inner life, their feelings, their thoughts, what they mean by the signals they send. Those are things that actually could be quite helpful for him as he enters the adolescent period.
You give a lot of examples of Mindsight exercises in the book. Can you share one that is maybe simple enough we can describe it just on the radio?
Yeah, well, a Mindsight exercise would be simply, how do you see the mind? So you say, well, what is the mind? On one level, the mind is your feelings. another level, the mind is your thoughts. So in the book, we have exercises where I teach you how to basically sift the mind. Now, what is sift? S-I-F-T is the acronym. You first sense your sensations. That's the S. And that would mean, what's your heart doing? What's your sensation of your lungs breathing in and out? What's the feeling in your intestines? What's the sensation from your muscles? It's a very simple exercise, but it's amazing these days with kids so focused on the internet and on screens, how little they pay attention to their own sensations. So that's the S. I is imagery. We go through an exercise where you try to imagine visual images that are in your mind, or even hearing sounds like a song. And taking that time to reflect inward on images, very, very important for getting to know what's going on in certain parts of your brain that are very tuned into what's going on inside of you. What's the F? Feelings. Feelings are the emotions that you have, and it's also something that is very important for us to be able to not only be aware of, but actually to name, and that's the basis of emotional intelligence. And the T, you can imagine, is thought. So you can pay attention to what you're thinking. And so one of the exercises of the many in the book is to learn how to sift your mind. So for someone who's learning MindSight, whether they're someone who's developing typically or someone on the autism spectrum, it's really important to learn this sifting technique. It's the basis for MindSight. And when you can sift your own mind, it actually develops the same circuitry in your brain that you're going to use to sift the mind of another person. And that's basically the basis of empathy. And when we're in empathic relationships, when you really sense another person's inner life, those are the kinds of communications that make us feel close to someone, that allow us to have supportive relationships. And these relationships are very important for how we develop well-being in life.
Thanks for the call, Julie. We'll go to the phones again with Lori in Dodgeville. Lori, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's a great program. You know, I was wondering, between boys and girls, I have a son, he's now 19, and I was wondering, he's been a risk taker since he was two. Is there a big difference between boys and girls as far as risk taking? And once they get to be like 19, my son is, will he stop, you know, taking, or when does that stop, the risk taking?
Yeah.
Because he's still pretty adventurous.
Yes, it's a great question. I can tell you, you know, my father-in-law, Neil, who's on the line, and my mother-in-law, Betty, you know, in Wisconsin, they had a farm, and they had two boys and two girls. And I can tell you from the family stories, the boys were risk-takers, and the girls were not risk-takers. And you see this kind of thing in general with what you would do on a tractor or what you would do running around. And this kind of danger that boys are more likely to get into can happen more with boys, and I think your son is experiencing it. Now, this is not globally across the genders, but what you can see is that some boys don't take physical risks, and some girls do. So you see a whole spectrum. Now, your question is, well, if my son was taking risks when he was younger, is he going to continue taking risks? And part of this relates to temperament. So we do know some kids are born with a temperament that gets them to try out physical things that are more likely to hurt themselves, and other people are more what's called risk averse, and that can be a trait that can continue. But the fact is that as he goes through adolescence, he may actually develop out of this, because he may come to realize that he doesn't like his body getting injured. He may, as he develops into the 20s, because adolescence goes into that age, he may really learn that, you know, this is not something I really care to do. If he does the MindSight skill work that's in the book, he's going to develop this internal compass we were talking about that will allow him, when he's approaching a choice on a behavior, riding a motorcycle without a helmet, jumping off, you know, a cliff, or, you know, all sorts of things I give examples of in the book, he may pause, reflect on whether he wants to carry out that impulse, and then choose not to carry it out. And so a MindSight skill can actually develop the part of the brain that allows you to decrease risk-taking behavior. And this is why I wrote the book for adolescents as well as adults, is because if an adolescent reads the book and does the exercises, it can develop the part of his brain that can make the chance of getting injured from risky behaviors much less. And this is where, you know, it would be up to him to choose to do it. You can't tell him to do it. But if he decided that's what he wanted to do, these are the kind of skills he would need to develop to stop taking those risks.
Dr. Siegel, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you. And keep warm in this wonderful weather you're having.
We will try. That's Dr. Daniel Siegel. His new book is Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about why one publication just called Milwaukee one of the worst-run cities in America. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The economics blog 24/7 Wall Street recently published a list of the 10 worst-run cities in America, which was also featured in the Huffington Post, and Wisconsin's largest city, Milwaukee, made the list, coming in at number 10.
The report took into account things like poverty, education, crime, and city credit rating. We've talked with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett in the past, and he's made the case for his accomplishments in the city.
Today, we'll get another perspective on how well the city of Milwaukee runs with Milwaukee-based columnist Eugene Kane, and we're also happy to hear from you on this. When if you have an opinion on the matter, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Eugene, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica. Good to talk to you.
Well, what did you think when you saw 24/7 Wall Street had Milwaukee as the 10th worst-run city on their list?
Well, I have to tell you, my first reaction as a journalist is to wonder, well, what is 24/7 Wall Street? I mean, it is cited as the source of the study, and I have to be honest and say I hadn't really heard of it before. But at the same time, I've dealt over the years with various worst lists that include Milwaukee. Usually, in my experience, it has been in terms of social indicators that negatively affect the African-American community. But this one seems to be a blanket indictment of the city as a whole as being worse run. So that kind of raised my eyebrows. And then looking over the list, it just seemed to be a very interesting mix of cities, including some cities much bigger than Milwaukee. I think Cleveland, Detroit would qualify. And then some other smaller cities, even out in California, like San Bernardino.
That was the worst one, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing that flagged me about San Bernardino is that they were involved in a big corruption scandal a couple years ago, but that was San Bernardino County. So I guess I'm at a loss to explain exactly what the criteria. You're always at a loss to figure out when they publish these lists, what is their real main criteria?
Well, I know some of the indicators they were looking at, debt was one, crime was another, GDP another, things like that. And I wonder if you want to address a few of those in terms of...
Well, I do think the reason it has some credibility is that if you want to point out the most damaging social indicators or issues in Milwaukee, hey, poverty, education, crime, unemployment, you're hitting that right on the nail, whether it's for the black community or the larger community. I mean, those are paramount issues in this town. And the fact that Milwaukee is included in a study that also includes cities much larger than we are, like Midwestern cities like Cleveland and Detroit, that gives you a sense that, yeah, maybe this is an issue that needs to be addressed because we're kind of finishing real high in these real bad categories. So I think a lot of people will respond to that if the reason Milwaukee is listed as the 10th worst run city is because of the way we handle things like poverty, education, and crime, and unemployment, yeah, I think a lot of people agree with that.
Now, poverty is one that Mayor Barrett has weighed in regards specifically to this list, and he said, yeah, you got us on that one. We need to do better, and we're working on it. When it comes to debt, that's one that he has taken issue with and sort of defended Milwaukee. Do you want to speak to the debt issue in Milwaukee?
Well, I'm sure from his perspective, you know, the mayor is looking at it, you know, from a top-down perspective that he has experts and people on his staff who have analyzed this. And, again, it's this whole ranking us against other cities that creates these sort of, you know, lists that create a lot of anxiety and, I guess, even debate about the way this is happening. But I think the best way is to talk to people in Milwaukee. As a journalist, I've talked to people in Milwaukee from different classes, different income levels. And the people on the bottom do cite this as being a particularly bad city. Again, I will admit that I'm talking specifically myself about African Americans I've talked to, that this is a hard place for a black man to be unemployed. It's a hard place for a black family to, you know, to earn a livable income that will allow them, you know, to sort of enjoy the things in life that hardworking people should enjoy. So these are all things that I think the mayor is probably defensive about, but I think he also acknowledges in terms of things about raising the minimum wage, and there are things Milwaukee could do to make it more livable for people on those bottom scales.
Well, so living in Milwaukee, you said you're a journalist, you're out there talking to people, you live in the city. Does it feel like Milwaukee is a poorly run city to you?
I think it's a peculiar, I think I would say it's a very peculiar city in terms of the way certain institutions work, and I could even go to something as basic as outside parking regulations. I mean, I had a recent talk with people who asked me why, you know, Milwaukee has a system where you have to pay money to park outside your home on the streets. And that's something very peculiar to Milwaukee, and I don't know if that falls in the category of that means it's worse run, but I do think talking to people, they do think other cities do things better than they do here in Milwaukee, which is, I think, is the intent of a survey like this, worst run, best run. I think that's all on account of what citizens think or residents think. Can things be done better? Crime? I mean, I think people accept the fact that Milwaukee is not as safe a city as it should be, given the resources we have to, you know, to battle crime and the things we could do to prevent crime. So that's what I think is an interesting way for them to frame this list, best or worst run cities. And living in Milwaukee day to day, I don't see it as a totally badly run city, but I do see peculiar things that happen that make you think, well, maybe we could address this a little differently, whether it's transportation issues or racial issues or government issues, taxing issues.
Well, let's get our callers in on this. We've got Nate with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was going to point out two things, and I'm arguably a defender of Milwaukee at the moment, because if you're talking about the social impacts like poverty, one of the things that I think should be brought up is that Milwaukee is part of a metro area, and without recognizing how well the communities within a metro area work together or choose not to work together, you're actually not measuring how well the city itself is run. And the city itself, I would say, and maybe you brought this up a little bit, faced some financial hard spots, and I think came through them reasonably well, which someone could actually say is a measure of how well the city's run. And so the study may be mislabeled or mistitled.
All right. Interesting points there, Nate. So what do you make of that, Eugene?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's just a weird, maybe not weird, but it's a peculiar way to frame the study, what's best run and worst run, and then you use things like the credit rating, poverty, education, crime, unemployment, and the regional GDP, and they don't really give much of an explanation as to why these things account to whether the city is run well or not. Because it seems to me poverty, crime, education, these are a lot of things that, you know, are out because they're so affected by social conditions. I'm not sure if you can put the onus on people who run the city to address that, which I think is part of what Mayor Barrett is trying to tell people.
You think
know, there
that's,
are a lot of things that are essentially out of government's control.
You think that's maybe up to bigger dogs?
Well, it might be, yeah. Very, very well might be.
Do Milwaukee's challenges come from being a poorly run state? I mean, you're talking about these bigger factors. Are you talking about, you know, the government then, that maybe we've got something that's sweeping across the country and it's not fair to point a finger at Milwaukee?
Well, Milwaukee, my experience, having lived in just a couple other different cities, grown up in back east in Philadelphia, spent some time in California, and then, you know, other parts of the country for short amounts of time. I've lived in Milwaukee for close to 30 years, and my comparison of these other with the way things are run here and in other parts of the country, particularly the East Coast and the Washington, D.C. area, you don't really see that much difference because people are in an extreme state everywhere nowadays, or in a lot of major cities these days. So a lot of the unemployment and poverty and education, what major city doesn't have a big problem with their public education system these days? And particularly us, we here in the Midwest, we have situations that are endemic to our geographic location and the Rust Belt phenomenon and the loss of jobs to warmer and different parts of the country. So, I mean, how much control does the government have, the local government have, over those kind of factors? And I think Wisconsin and Milwaukee are a very fascinating place to kind of figure out where we can try to solve some of these things. And it's going to depend on leadership. And I think the reason people responded to this study is because it seems like a real indictment of leadership, worst run. When mm-hmm. you tell somebody you're the worst run city or one of 10 worst run cities, that's a real indictment on the people who are allegedly running the city. So I understand why it's getting this much buzz, but my attitude is that it's not that much different in other places, so maybe people shouldn't really freak out about it, but just still don't ignore it. Don't, you know, ignore the real substantive issues that were raised in this study.
Eugene, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your thoughts.
Oh, well, thank you for the invitation.
We've been speaking with Eugene Kane. He's a Milwaukee-based columnist. We've been talking about Milwaukee's recent ranking as the 10th worst-run city in the country. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The United States Congress is back to work in the new year after a 2013 marked by historic levels of inaction. In 2013, the words gridlock and partisanship became almost synonymous with congressional politics, culminating in that 16-day government shutdown.
Now, at the start of a congressional election year, Congress's approval rating stands at a mere 13%. In response this year, we'd like to shine a light on the workings of Congress and really see where government is and is not working. We'll ask who's getting what done, where the obstacles lie, and explore possibilities for compromise.
And ask, will 2014 be the year that Congress gets its act together? Or will next November see a frustrated electorate ready to shake things up?
Joining us in our exploration of Congress is USA Today politics and Congress editor Paul Singer. He also runs the blog How Government Works and tweets at Singer News. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Veronica. How you doing?
Doing okay. Glad to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So making headlines this week is the Senate's debate on extending unemployment benefits. Yesterday, it looked like the bill might not have a chance of reaching the floor for debate. What happened?
Well, enough Republicans, a half dozen Republicans, voted with all the Democrats to go ahead and bring the bill to the floor, which was kind of a surprise. We thought they might not. Of course, voting to bring it to the floor and voting to pass it are two different things, so don't get your hopes up just yet. But the bill is now sort of center stage. This is the conversation that will be taking place the next couple of days of whether or not Congress can free up about $6 billion for a three-month extension of unemployment benefits for about 1.3 million people.
Now, looking at those Republicans who voted with Democrats to bring it to the floor, if we look at that, do we say, well, look at that, it's got some bipartisan support, so prospects look pretty good?
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe or no. You know, this is Congress. Just because you voted to, like I said, voted for the debate doesn't mean you voted for the bill. I mean, what's at issue here is the Republicans believe that unemployment and insurance benefits, unemployment benefits, particularly these sort of long-term benefits, this is now extending the benefits you're already entitled to, should be paid for with cuts in other government programs, offset, because otherwise you're just adding to the deficit. Democrats argue, well, no, this is an emergency situation. The economy's still bad. Job growth has not improved fast enough. We should just, it's like when there's a hurricane or a tornado or an earthquake, we just give that money as an emergency relief. We don't ask for it to be offset with cuts someplace else. That is the philosophical problem. You have the two parties having a very different view of this. And I honestly don't know what's going to happen, because I think everybody wants to show compassion for people who remain unemployed. But the Republicans feel like we can't continue to simply extend and extend and extend and extend these benefits without cuts somewhere else to pay for it.
Well, they have been extended, what, something like 11 times already. Is there a reason that this particular time might be harder or easier?
Well, harder because they already expired. Since the benefits already expired at the end of December, you are now more or less retroactively reinstating them back to the end of December. You know what I mean? It's easier to keep a program alive than it is to resuscitate it once it's dead. And that's the first problem. The second problem is that in general, they do these things in other bills. So there's other sweeteners, as we like to call them. You know, if you're going to fund the entire government and then you stick unemployment inside that, well, then no one's going to vote against the entire bill just because they have a philosophical argument. Well, here, now you've got a standalone bill. And so it's much tougher to pass that. One of the reasons Congress doesn't get anything done is because they can't pass standalone bills on anything unless they're full of sweeteners.
And what about philosophical reasons? We talked a little bit about that, about not wanting to add to the deficit. But do you get the sense that there are Republicans that seem genuinely in favor of passing this bill?
Yeah, no, I don't think, in fact, I would not argue the Republicans oppose the extension of benefits. The opposition comes to extension of benefits with no adjacent cut in spending. And I mean, I think they can be accused, and they will be accused by Democrats, of a lack of compassion, right? But they argue the reverse, that it is more compassionate to, you know, cut the deficit so that you're not burdening the next generation. Also, the Republicans are arguing that they have other jobs bills out there that would actually create jobs that would be more beneficial than just extending unemployment benefits, and that those jobs have languished because the Democratic Senate doesn't want to pick them up.
What concessions will Republicans look for from Democrats if they do end up passing this bill?
Well, that is the magic question. That is the point of debate today. In the Senate, is exactly what concessions they would need to sign on. Will they, you know, want a specified set of cuts in various programs? Do they want, at the moment, frankly, the argument is over a whole bunch of Senate procedure. Oh, we need the right to bring up this amendment or that amendment. Senator McConnell yesterday tried to bring up an amendment that would delay the implementation of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. You might not be surprised to know that did not go anywhere. And that's the sort of thing the Democrats say, well, if you're going to do that kind of grandstanding, then to heck with you. We're just going to pass the bill, ram it down your throats, and move on. This is where you get into the fact that these guys just can't work together very well.
And Republicans, some of them, have been saying that this bill is a distraction from Obamacare, and its political posturing on the part of the Democrats. Is rhetoric like that getting in the way, or is that just business as usual?
I think that is just where we are. I mean, you are in a extraordinarily divided political climate. Nobody ever makes a mistake in this Congress. You simply commit sins and transgressions, right? Nobody is ever wrong on an issue. They are philosophically criminally wrong on an issue. I mean, it's everything becomes end of the world rhetoric. And nobody wants to sit down and say, well, you know, we could probably work with you guys on this. Why don't we try this? There's just nothing to be gained from sitting down and agreeing. People make money off of screaming at each other and calling them evil.
Wow.
Yeah, no,
that
man.
Sounds hopeful.
I've been doing this a long time, man.
Well, let's talk about how the bill might proceed, should it proceed. What are some of the options that might happen?
It's hard. Well, here's what we think might happen, but forgive me that, honestly, because the Senate, as you may or may not know, operates without any real rules, all of this is hypothesis, right? It could change tomorrow. One thing that could happen is the Democrats and Republicans could agree, let's vote on a couple of Republican amendments and then pass the bill, right? That would give Republicans an opportunity to sort of air their options, probably lose, and then have a final vote on the bill, which may or may not pass. That is, I think, the path they would like to be able to take, get that done by the end of this week, and then offer it to the House. Keep in mind, the House of Representatives has made no real indication they want to take this thing up anyway. The other possibility, which is uglier, is that they can't come to an agreement, and then we get to another 60-vote threshold cloture vote, another filibuster. I expect some of this to resolve by the end of this week. I think the Senate wants to be done with this by the end of the week. Keep in mind, you know, they still have to get around to actually funding the government, which in theory runs out of money next Tuesday.
All right, that sounds pretty important too.
Yeah, right. One would hope.
All right, a lot going on. Paul, thank you so much for helping us sort it out today. Appreciate you joining us.
It is my pleasure, and I certainly apologize if I gave you a sense of doom and gloom. It's all fun.
No, I'm terribly optimistic. Thank you so much. That was Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today, when we've been talking with him about the inside workings of Congress.